This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. You're with me, Melissa Idris, Sharad Kutan and Ibrahim Sani. You'll also hear from Julian Ng on The Breakfast Grill later today.
Good morning. It's hump day. Always an exciting day for me because I kind of measure the week in terms of these. Sorry. I measure these the days in terms of the, you know, these kind of like high points, you know. So I think of hump day as a kind of high point in the week.
Yeah, humping is always a high point for everyone. But yes, this is indeed midweek, and yes, enjoying our midweek. Yeah.
All right. So coming up on The Breakfast Grill, we have James Lin, the head of products for Southeast Asia for Visa. We're going to be talking about credit cards and debit cards and other forms of plastic. Also, consumer spending, because if you think about it, Visa has really a bird's eye view of kind of the consumer sentiment, if they're spending, if they're using their credit cards.
Yeah, Visa is one of the two payment houses that is largely dominating the market share right now, the other one being MasterCard. And Visa and MasterCard always has that tussle about that 51%, 49%, whoever owns that slightly larger market share. Now, one thing interesting about Visa is that they partner with slightly larger banks in Malaysia. So they have a greater penetration in terms of market share of the number of banks in Malaysia, but MasterCard has the biggest bank in Malaysia, which is Maybank. So the ability for them to understand the market is there. Consumer spending is there. So right now, analytics is the biggest thing either in Visa and MasterCard. And I'm pretty sure
The analytics that drive how they shape their business? Is that what you're saying?
No, the analytics on consumer spending, what they buy, when they buy it, how much they buy it.
You know, I mean, I wonder what the situation is in Malaysia in terms of credit card debt, the ease of which, especially young people, can get a credit card, and how many of them actually spin out of control as a consequence of having a credit
card. Spending on credit card. It's so easy to swipe when you don't actually feel the physical cash, right? I also am curious to know if people have loyalties to, you know, between Visa and MasterCard, for instance. Do they have one or the other? Do they opt to use one or the other, if there are certain privileges of using one over the other?
I mean, you get an option. I mean, banks will give you both cards, won't they?
Yeah, or you get an option of whether you prefer, you know, one or the other. I think quite interesting to hear all these different angles from Visa on The Breakfast Grill. James Lin, head of products for Southeast Asia. And after the grill, 8:35, we're going to be taking a look at the ongoing Philippine presidential race. I don't know about you guys. Do you think that it's taken a bit of a backseat for being overshadowed by the race to the White House, perhaps?
Yeah, this is interesting because in the White House, the race has taken an interesting turn. Ted Cruz and John Kasich is now splitting states. Mm-hmm. They're not going to run in head-on.
It's a tag team against Trump, right?
Yeah. So there is a dynamic of Republican primaries there in the U.S. In the Philippines, they might. I was reading last night on the Nikkei Review. It was on this whole splitting head-on thing. So it's really, you know, 3 versus 3, but actually 6 people contesting for the presidency, something like that.
Well, okay, but they're actually slightly different races. One is a presidential race. That's what's happening in the Philippines. And in the U.S. are primaries, right? So they're basically races within parties to decide who gets the nomination, right? And
for the presidency.
Presidential, yeah. But still, it's still one step removed from...
Not quite yet.
So they're slightly different. I mean, they're significantly different, I think, in that... the winners of the American race will not be crowned president. But I think what's interesting is that they now, it seems in the Philippines, we have a clear front runner, and it's the former mayor of Davao City in the south, Duterte. And he is, it looks like he's the man who's going to clinch the vote unless something extraordinary happens in the coming days. What's interesting about him is that he's styled himself as a kind of Trump-like politician, plain speaking, not given to political correctness. In fact, so not given to political correctness that he makes light of issues like rape and rape, murder, particular instance where a missionary was raped and murdered in a prison outbreak riot situation. He, of course, has also made a name for himself for going after criminals in his city, not necessarily using the most legal of routes. So he's all for this kind of vigilantism and you know, extrajudicial killing. So he's associated with that phenomena in the Philippines as well. But all this adds up to him being a man of action, which contrasts with the current president, Aquino, who's seen as somehow dithering and not hard, not a tough man.
Well, you know, if we could draw similarities again to Trump, right? There's been a lot of talk about Trump reinventing himself, or Trump the candidate will not probably be the same as a President Trump. You know, perhaps being the White House would move him to the center a little bit more. So perhaps, you know, the comments that Duterte is making could likely be just to instigate, you know, to instigate voters to get the rallies going, so to speak.
But, you know, I mean, how much can you... He's actually called for Congress to be abolished. He's kind of styling himself as a kind of authoritarian, maybe in the Marcos mode, because people...
But people appeal to that, isn't it? At least in Philippines. I mean, he's getting
there's an
traction.
Appeal. Yeah, there is an appeal among some people for a kind of strong leadership. Whether strong leadership needs to be anti-democratic, one that seeks to hollow out institutions.
You know, I read a really interesting piece about Trump and his appeal, and his name escapes me at the moment, but I read it on New York Times, said that Trump is essentially a bully, and people who like candidates like Trump, like Duterte, for instance, are people attracted to power and want to be on the team that is the bully, essentially. You don't want to be caught on the other side of a bully, right? And that just lingered with me because I do see some truth to that.
Yeah, it's true. And this one thing interesting is that the Philippines election is meant to be a little bit more democratic than other Southeast Asian countries. So the winner will actually really have the will of the people. And I'm really interested to see who wins.
I think we'll speak to Keith Leong from Karim Razan Associates after the 8:30 news for more kind of insights into what's happening. There's also a race for vice presidency, and that's in the lead for that is Senator Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr. He, of course, is the son of the late dictator Ferdinand Marcos.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's Current Affairs, 8:30, 5 a.m. Also on the show today, we have the S&M Show, 9:30, 5 a.m. Our guest is James Hay, the founder of the long-term value-focused Pangolin Fund, and he's going to be talking about the Pangolin rules of investing and why he thinks investors cannot buy low and sell high. So that's on the S&M Show today, 9:30, 5 a.m. Quick time check. It's now 6:08. A look at the late-breaking news last night. Apple's revenue was down 13% as iPhone sales fell. This breaks 13 years of continuous quarterly growth. 13 yeah. years.
So I had a Market Watch interview with Dodge Dolan on Monday morning, and he was extremely concerned about Apple because he views Apple as a conduit or a proxy to the consumer market. And basically, if he says that if there is a drop, it basically means that there's going to be a weakening sentiment in the U.S. in terms of consumer spending, and that's bad for the economy.
Which is cause effect. So the drop is the effect of dampening consumer confidence, rather than the other way.
Well, iPhone sales have fallen, so that's clearly, I mean, Apple
a symptom.
And the questions have been raised whether Apple has reached a saturation point in terms of potential customers.
They're fully aware of this, and that's why they're launching below market price, normal market price of iPhones, the stripped down versions. The latest iPhone SE, for instance, is cheaper. It's one of the cheapest handphones they've ever made, and that's because they want to target the Chinese consumers, the Indian consumers, where they are still having a low penetration rate. So that level of saturation is there. They are cognizant of that, but you know, it's not making, you know, headwinds. I don't think consumers in China or India, you know, together is 2.5 billion people worth of consumers. They're really driven by an iPhone. They can get far cheaper, better handphones out there.
Well, what about the cachet associated with the brand? I'm watching.
What do you mean?
That, you know, if you watch, so I'm now watching House of Cards, right? And what I notice is the kind of computers or laptops being used by, you know, different characters. And so the protagonist, you know, Francis
Underwood.
Oh, antagonist.
And his he's the protagonist. He's the main he's the main character, right? He and his wife both use Apple. But then when, you know, the lower down the social order in terms of characters, they use Dell. They do all kinds
of. Yeah, I've never noticed that.
Yeah, they don't use Apple. So I think Apples are for higher order beings in this this world of, you know.
Look at you, you know, thinking about metaphors and electronic gadgets.
Well, let's look at me.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think as a company, it's interesting to see, just simply because, you know, they focus on China and the fact that China is slowing down, what this means for them, whether or not they're able to recapture the glory days of innovation and, you know, releasing really market-moving technology.
Yeah, so technological breaks are often the way in which you capture new markets and, you know, extend your sales, isn't it? You create something that nobody else has, rather than either a pared-down version of what you already have or versions of what somebody else has. Mm. You actually create something that's new. And so,
although a lot of people say that Apple didn't actually create the smartphone, they just created the most user-friendly version of a smartphone. They brought it to mass market, essentially.
Well, and so, you know, that's the way. Short of selling it to Martians, I mean, they're going to have to wow the market again with something everybody wants.
Okay, looking at other news, back home, Selangor Menteri Besar Datuk Seri Azmin Ali is being investigated under the Sedition Act. This is over billboards across Selangor that has described Datuk Seri Anwar Ibrahim as a political prisoner. So yesterday, police recorded Azmin's statement for about 90 minutes at the police headquarters in PJ, which now the billboards have been taken down by cops.
Yeah, that whole billboard was approved by him because of the his ability to wield the power of Menteri Besar on the local districts. So Majlis Bandar Shah Alam, Majlis Bandar Putrajaya, Jaya, the list goes on, right?
All the local councils.
Yeah, local councils. Mm-hmm. And it's a difficult. You see, in the world of law, the smaller the burden of proof, the better you are in prosecuting that particular plaintiff or defendant, right? And it's a leap, actually, if you ask me. How is it that by saying that Anwar is a political prisoner, that equates to sedition? Because it doesn't harm the country directly, so there is an indirect harm. Now, the prosecution has to prove that indirect harm, and it's difficult.
No, actually, I think the problem with the Sedition Act is it's so loosely framed that it's bad law precisely because it is so open to interpretation, and you know, so basically you can catch all kinds of issues. I think the other issue for a lot of observers of Malaysian politics is clearly the use of the Sedition Act against you know, members of the federal opposition. I think that's become clear. We had over the last week eight you know, people arrested and questioned, or at least questioned by the police, also in connection with apparently seditious remarks, including somebody we spoke to him on BFM about, you know, because he created an online petition calling for the Prime Minister to step down. So again, you know, the political use of the law, one, a law that in many ways is quite badly framed because it's so loose.
In other news, Tun Dr. Mahathir is in focus at the moment because, according to the press secretary to the Prime Minister, Dato' Sri Tunku Sharifuddin, he has called on Dr. M to announced the intentions for Save Malaysia. Who will be the next Prime Minister under the Save Malaysia campaign? So there are rumours that Tun M wants his son, Mukhris, to be Prime Minister. And that, I think, has become quite a sore point among the people, among the parties working together under Save Malaysia.
You know, last night I was watching Bulletin Utama, and about 10 minutes was given airtime of the Prime Minister's press secretary, Dato' Sri Tengku Sharifuddin. Can you imagine that?
His press sec is a household name.
Yes, and he was actually drumming it in that Dr. Mahathir should retire with dignity, Dr. Mahathir should let go, Mukhris should stand on his own 2 feet. You know, these kind of statements come out from him.
I think kind of the politics and the rhetoric between the two camps or the several camps in Malaysian politics ramps up these kind of accusations. But it's a fair question on one level, right? Mm. We always want to know what the intentions of what's behind certain agendas. Of course, Dr. Mahathir's campaign will call itself the Save Malaysia campaign, because that's exactly what you say in a campaign. You don't call it Save Malaysia in order to push my son up to become the next Prime Minister.
That's
campaign. But I think but this is a part of the politics, right? There will be, and you're thinking a few steps ahead. What I guess the Prime Minister's camp wants to do is to cast doubt on the purity of Dr. Mahathir's intentions, right? And say, well, actually, there might be a mix of things. There might be some other agendas. And it's very interesting because this morning, Sina Harian has Dr. Mahathir on the cover.
Oh.
And he's because weighing in on the 1MDB debacle, calling on Arul Kanda to not hold back, not keep any secrets.
Now, Prince left no known will when he died last week. And so now his six siblings or half-siblings have claimed to be heirs to a legacy which is estimated at hundreds of millions of dollars, because aside from royalties from more than Prince's 30 albums, he had also retained ownership of his master recordings. He was also said to have a number of unheard recordings, including an album cut with Miles Davis. I love Miles Davis. So it really boils down, we were talking about it this morning, whether it surprised us that someone who had such a great fortune would neglect to write a will. How could you not do that?
Yeah, for Muslims around the world, particularly run by a Muslim country like Malaysia, this is excluding us because of the Islamic inheritance law. So, you know...
So, the Islamic inheritance law doesn't require individual Muslims to actually write will, because there's already a system
in place. It's not even doesn't require. There's no point in writing one, because it can easily be superseded if a family member wants to invoke it. So, let's say I have two girls and one son. My property would be divided into four portions. My son would get half, and my two girls will get one quarter each. That is under the Islamic law. So if I write a will and I bequeath everything to my favorite daughter, leaving nothing for my two other children, my two other children can invoke the Islamic inheritance law to nullify my own will.
So what about? So what would you have to do if you actually wanted to give your favorite daughter a bigger piece of the pie?
You do it before you die.
You gift it to her.
And that's right. The term is hiba, which is gift, and you gift it while you are still living.
Well, so there's that. I think for non-Muslims, because there are all kinds of non-Muslims, but non-Muslims like myself, coming from a family where despite having, you know, maybe resources to get a lawyer and do this kind of things, I also know individuals who have not written wills or written very bad wills,
which
is the other thing, right?
Uh-huh.
But I do notice, I mean, I'm just thinking of personally, I'm 50 now and I haven't written a will, and I really should. And I've been telling myself that for some time. So it might have been that Prince, you know, being so young, just didn't come around to it because he thought, well, I'm going to live for some time. I'll leave it till next weekend.
Yeah.
So what people normally do is that they write a first draft of the will, leave it with the executor, and that will gets redrafted over time.
So the executor of the will is, that's also a contentious point, right? So if I say I elect my say I had many siblings and I elect one of them personally as the executor of the will and it's not formalized. And then upon my death, he holds up this draft. Will it stand up in court? And, you know, what would the other siblings think?
Well, I mean, that's precisely what's happening with Prince's sister at the moment. Taika Nelson went to court to say that a special administrator should be appointed to handle Prince's affairs and she should be appointed to probate his estate and, you know, sort this out. So I guess right now that's precisely what's happening to Prince. However, I do want to say, broaching the question of having a will written up is a difficult one, especially, okay, I don't know how many families do this, but how do you discuss the issue of a will within the family?
How do you discuss the issue of death, which we all will face,
and
the need for a will, right? So I've share something rather personal, is that, you know, in discussing this with my mother, having known the difficulties we faced when we dealt with her mother's estate, despite those difficulties as a kind of, you know, like a hard lesson in the need for solid wills, my mother was very hesitant. In fact, I don't think she liked it that I brought this issue up, and she thought it was rather unseemly. And I can see why she might think so. She's like, I'm trying to hasten my mother to her death.
Oh, dear.
Because having, you know, but I did, when trying to talk to my mother about these issues, learn several things. One is, in the decision in naming the executor, right? So the executor is the person who you give power to fulfill your wishes that are in the will. And she thought that if she made my brother the executor, my elder brother, that somehow I would feel slighted. And I said, no way, you know, I think he's the right choice. I mean, he clearly lives in the same country, you know, shares the same citizenship as you do, and it will just be a much smarter move. But she thought that that act itself was
like
a sign,
picking favorites. Okay.
So, you know, and I think sometimes people don't even understand basic concepts. So I would never have thought that the choice of my brother or myself in any way reflected, you know, a favoritism on my mother's part. She was just looking at the most likely person, to be able to fulfill her wishes.
I don't know about you guys, but I think almost every family has had experience of, you know, fighting over property or a will, or whether you or your partner's family has had that experience. And it's, you know, you've seen the worst come out from people and families torn apart, relationships really suffered from it.
That's right. And this kind of feud, you wouldn't have expected to come from one of the most quiet guys, the most quiet auntie, the most timid uncle. But they really jump into action and they really want that, you know, asset, that property, whatever.
It brings together the two most awkward subjects, death and money, right? You just don't want to talk about these two things.
Or death and inheritance, because it's not always money. I mean,
things can be tense.
But, you know, some years ago, my mother gave away her book collection. She'd been collecting books for the last, 40, 50 years or something. And she decided that she would give her books away to this private library. And it's a collection of novels, Malayan novels and all that. And I was so upset. I was like, how could you give them that? You know, look, you know, I would want that, because for me, that would be more valuable than anything else. I mean, well, not more valuable than anything else, but clearly
it would be value
to myself, right? And I think she had all kinds of reasons for thinking, you know, it was necessary to do this. It's not like an extraordinarily large book collection, but it was, and precisely because of the point, it wasn't about that. It wasn't like it was full of precious books or rare books. It was just that it was my mother's book collection.
So what do you do? I mean, if you don't think that the person who has written a will is fair, you don't think the will itself is fair, because you're talking about bad wills, Sharad, earlier, do you challenge that, or do you respect the person's last wishes? And when I say the person, essentially it's your family, it's your parents or your whomever it is that you love, right? So there's always that relationship, I think, muddies the waters a bit.
I think it's not so much who's given what that constitutes a bad will. It's badly written, meaning there are ambiguities. That will create confusion or tension. Because when your intentions are not clear, that's when people can fight. But a solid will is one where the intentions are very clearly stated. And people might not be happy.
Yeah, what if they don't think it's fair?
Well, I think that you can contest. Challenge. You okay. can contest. Well, but I'm not. I don't claim to know the legalities of that. But I'm sure everything can be challenged. Whether it can be challenged successfully or not is another question.
Now, on June 5th, Switzerland will vote on the Unconditional Basic Income Initiative. So the idea is as simple as it is radical, rather than concern itself with managing a whole range of social welfare and unemployment insurance programs. The government, the Swiss government, would instead cut regular, no-strings-attached checks to each citizen. So this is no conditions, no questions asked. Everyone, rich or poor, employed or not, will get the same amount of money. This is the Basic Income Initiative.
It's very interesting as a thought experiment. You know, what will people do with the money? Mm. Where would they put it? But immediately you can think of all kinds of problems, right? Including the fact that, you know, the question around some goods that governments have to provide, like education, health, who would pay for that? Would that be paid out of the basic thing, or would you still have those services provided free of charge?
So, I mean, part of the referendum is that they don't mention the specifics of this initiative. They don't say how much this basic income is going to be, how the government plans on financing it. But you're right, as a social experiment, as a thought experiment, what would this mean for the way people live in Switzerland, right? If people no longer had to worry about making ends meet, what would they do with their lives? They can pursue the lives that they want to pursue. Would that mean giving back to society?
That's right. I think this is a direct way to free yourself from the encumbrances of day-to-day limitations. Because, we focus on, putting bread on the table. What happens if the bread is there already on the table? What can you do next, right? That future ministers that we talked about, all that. But one thing interesting about Switzerland is that they are one of the rare countries that have a direct democracy. Now, what that means is that every decision they make is sort of like a referendum.
Yeah.
They mail ballots to respective Swiss voters about policies or decisions. It slows the process down, but it basically asks the will of the people straight up.
Okay. Well, coming back to the very idea, what would you do if you had all this time? How different is this, say, from welfare checks? In Britain, it's called the dole, isn't it?
But that's only for the unemployed, right?
Okay. So the idea here, it would extend beyond the unemployed to those who have employment.
Yes.
So for us who have employment, who don't see work as an encumbrance, but we see it as enabling, that through work, yes, you might get a salary, but you also might have all kinds of self-realization potential, right? So you see yourself as somebody who, as people in the media do, see yourself as contributing to the betterment of your society through working in the media, in enriching the public sphere.
Mm.
And that's, so work is not always a bad thing. I mean, not everybody is lucky enough to do something they really enjoy and love.
But this could allow them to do that, right? So if you're not worried about, making money, if you know that your basic needs are taken care of, you could do what you wanted. You could join that NGO. You could pursue your passion. You could be that struggling artist, with
well,
all the...
Well, actually...
Well, it's no longer struggling. Now,
yeah, no longer struggling because you've got food on the table.
Well, in fact, you can do it now. Even in this world, without that government-guaranteed income, people still join civil society organizations, still pursue artistic careers.
Could this incentivize more people to join? I mean, if more people were not worried about making money, about taking care of their debts and their families... Could that incentivize them to join and really kind of contribute back to society? So you're talking, Sharad, about how will the government, shouldn't the government be looking at education and healthcare, for instance, rather than giving a blank check to each citizen? What if with that check, citizens could then volunteer to be teachers, could then, spend some of their time volunteering at hospitals, become part-time nurses? All those things can then happen, right?
Well, okay, I still don't see it, because for me, it sounds like all the things that you can do, even within the constraints that we have today. So it's for people, so who would benefit most from from something like this?
Each other.
No, I mean, really, which segment of society?
So to answer your question, let's take a look into who is struggling right now under present circumstances. I think single mothers, for instance, struggling with three kids. I think cab drivers who are the sole breadwinners and they have four young children and the wife is not working or is unable to work. These are the cluster groups that we know for a fact. You always know that one person that is always struggling. I know at least four single mothers who are struggling with themselves with their income.
Yeah, but this is not a welfare initiative. So if you read the article, and I'm going to tweet this out, it's not about saying, giving to the poor, which is just you can expand welfare programs, you can work on minimum wage so that, you know, and
it's
all
not,
kinds
it's
of
not as easy as you
but
think
but that's not
on,
what
on
this
expanding.
This is not what the initiative is about.
Yeah, this initiative
this
is a
is
blanket.
Why, that's
a
why
blanket,
it goes to everybody,
yeah.
including somebody who's employed or is
yeah.
making lots
so
of money.
So your question was, what's stopping individuals in today's paradigm from doing the things that they want to do? It's these individuals that are stopping. They can't actually drop everything. They can't actually leave their three or four kids behind and pursue that struggling artist role, right? They can't. If people do not have responsibilities, they don't have children, they don't have partners, spouses, parents that are ill that need to care of, yeah, do it.
But you see, this is not what the initiative is about, right? So the initiative is about saying, and it's a little more radical, I think, in its intention, rather than, because what I'm asking for, how different is this from the Dole? So you might be somebody struggling with three children, you might get a welfare check, or you might get state support. So, and that's what can happen already.
This would mean even CEOs get the basic income. So this is what the blanket support would mean. A basic income across the board, everyone gets it from the janitor to the CEO.
So why? So we understand that people on the lower end of the income spectrum will benefit from a guaranteed minimum wage, but or amount of money for their upkeep. But how would it transform the lives of people on the other end of the spectrum? Why give a rich person, maybe somebody who inherited money, why give them a basic income? What's that about?
Well, again, I think it goes back to that social experiment, that if people were not kind of tied to the idea that this job gives me a salary to pay my bills at the end of the day, would they then do other things with their lives, more meaningful things, for instance? Would their lives be of better quality? Would they spend it more with their families? One of the arguments I've heard, I'm reading in this article against this initiative, is the fact that they're worried about the potential effects of people's willingness to work. So if you're not concerned about earning a salary, why should you put in that extra effort? I'm going to go home after lunch and take a nap at home. I don't really care what my boss has to say, because I'm not tied to the fact that I need his approval, you know, to pay my bills at the end of the
day. So people who attack the welfare state make precisely the same argument. They say welfare payments make people lazy.
Mm-hmm.
It disincentivizes work and a whole range of things. And this comes out in real discussions in many countries in advanced democracies of the West, including France. Emmanuel Macron, the economy minister in Laurent Fabius's cabinet, famously came out saying, that the 35-hour week was not sacrosanct, that, you know, perhaps this was doing more damage to the French economy than it was doing good to the lives of French people.
Oh, how did that go down?
Very badly for a man from a left-wing party, from the Socialist Party, because the Socialist Party have gravitated so much to the centre that perhaps they're...
But, you know, at the end of the day, it's really hard for us to say whether this initiative is good or bad, simply because there's just no data on this. There's no empirical evidence to say if this would work or this wouldn't.
Yeah, that's just like our discussion on futures minister, the minister of future. It's difficult for us to quantify the positives of it because we haven't implemented it yet. But do we need it? I think we do. For somebody to think about something that happens to the country 200 years, 300 years down the road, I think that's critical. I think energy, I think our future, I think dependence on oil, these are the things that has to be thought of today.
That's a different discussion. The discussion about giving a minimum income to people goes back to our ideas of what a good society is.
Right.
So if you read the article, it talks about how people are unhappy. And I think this initiative came out of a meditation around the question of happiness and how do you bridge wealth and satisfaction, personal satisfaction, things that are not coming together in countries like Switzerland. So if you look at the initiator of and read the article, it really does. That's the premise of the initiative.
That's where it stems from. Yeah. You're right.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.